On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, Jack Harris of the California Post joins to pinch hit for Jake Mintz as my co-host. We talk about the Dodgers. What's going on with the Dodgers? What have they been up to since signing Edwin Diaz? Could they sign one of these big free agents left? Where might those guys end up? We also welcome in Lance Brozdowski of Marquee to talk about Edward Cabrera being traded to the Cubs, the ups and downs of that trade. And of course, it's Friday, so we give you the good, the bad, and the ugly. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world interested in a long-term, low AAV contract. I'm Jordan Schusterman. Jake Mintz still on vacation for one more episode. I am very excited to welcome in for his Barbacast debut, Jack Harris of the newly minted California Post. Jack, thank you so much for joining me. How are you this morning?
Jordan, I'm great. This is quite an honor for me to be here with you and get to be filling in the big shoes of Jake Mintz. So, and I'm happy with any term on any contract deal as someone with a new job. So,
Yes, that's true. I think it is interesting, right? We're always looking for security here in this industry. But I got to be honest, I'm just really tired. And this is going to be relevant to the Dodgers, who we're going to talk about here, since that's the team you cover. I'm just sick of seeing the same thing ever. The Dodgers, they would be interested in a short-term high AAV. It's like, yeah, I know. We get it. You don't want to give someone a 6 or 7 year deal. Come on, these guys want to know where they're going to be working in 2031. And these teams are not willing to listen. So, Jack, you are here. Obviously, you have covered the Dodgers for several years for the LA Times, of course. And we are, as you now transition to a same role with a new at a new outlet, the California Post, we are going to mostly focus on the Dodgers. But before we get started, like, who are you? What are you doing here? Establish your credentials for those who are unfamiliar with the Jack Harris resume.
not a ton of credentials to establish. I was at the LA Times since 2019, covering the Dodgers on a primary basis as the beat writer since 2022, which has meant a lot of long Octobers over the years, and then a couple of very short ones, which were, you know, kind of nice. I'm starting. I'm in my second week now with the California Post, which is basically like the sister paper of the New York Post. It's launching in Los Angeles this year. So excited about that. And it's just been obviously, like, covering the Dodgers, it's quite a world, but also allows you to get to meet a lot of great people in the baseball industry like you guys. So it's been cool.
That's very kind of you to say. And I always say when I'm looking for a guest host, by the way, I should also mention you're not the only special guest on this episode. Later on, you will hear my conversation already recorded with our good pal and former guest, not his debut, Lance Brozdowski of Marquee, talking about the Edward Cabrera trade, the Cubs making a deal this week. So we're going to cover that big move later on. But Jack is here to help us speculate. And that is really the stage of the offseason we are here at, and how relevant the Dodgers are to this we can get into. But let's get into it. It is our opener. Now, what is our opener exactly? Well, I think the best way to put it, Jack, is we are currently stuck in a staring contest between multiple parties and multiple, you know, priorities, I would say, involving four free agents at the top of the class and really five or six teams from what we can understand. It's possible now we've added a new one here in the Philadelphia Phillies. We can get to that in a second. But I do believe the Dodgers are part of this conversation, and you know ball, and you cover this stuff. So I think that your opinion and perspective is worthwhile. And I also think that the Dodgers are an important character that we should not be ruling out. So let's establish who those characters are, right? Because, you know, sure, we had some action earlier on in the offseason. You know, we see Pete Alonso go to a new team. We see Kyle Schwarber stay with his team. We see the Dodgers sign Edwin Diaz. Okay, a little flurry of activity. But now we are stuck in this interesting stalemate with Kyle Tucker, with Alex Bregman, with Bo Bichette, and Cody Bellinger. You have two of them are Scott Boras clients, famously. We got a Scobo update coming on later in this show, of course, involving Tarek Skubal. And then we also have the main characters involved, right? We have the Blue Jays, we have the Red Sox, we have the Yankees, We have the Dodgers. I think we now have the Cubs. And then according to some reporting from Matt Gelb of The Athletic, we also now have the Phillies. What is interesting to me about this situation is that each team is like involved in two of the players, but not all of the players. And so there's like these weird competing motivations and goals for each player in each team where you're saying, okay, if you're the agent for the player, you're saying, well, wait, I'm waiting for him to sign. If you're the team, you're saying, well, I'm waiting for him to sign. I want to know what's going to happen with him before I decide on this guy. And so everyone's just kind of looking at each other. Let's start with what you know best. Of those top four players, who do you sense that the Dodgers are seriously considering?
Yeah, I think there's three guys that kind of make sense in different ways, like you said. I mean, really, when I look at this in a big picture standpoint, it's like a big game of musical chairs, and the music's still going kind of slowly right now, and everybody's kind of walking around and trying to figure out, okay, like what's going to be the game plan here? Which for a team like the Dodgers, to go back to your short-term high AAV joke, like this is good. Right. Like this is what they want, because their approach this offseason has been, we're going to let the market develop. We have a really good team to begin with. So we're not going to go out and add another super long term contract to an already aging core. We'll see if someone's market kind of falls into a place where we can get them on a shorter term deal and pay them a lot of money, you know, for the short time we have them. So I think that applies to somebody like Kyle Tucker, who they were never really interested in doing like a 8 to 10 year deal or $400 million for. But if he's open to coming on a shorter term deal with opt outs and help fill a pretty big need, one of their few big needs in the outfield, they'd be happy to do that, I'd imagine. Cody Bellinger, another guy who obviously they're quite familiar with, who they've been impressed, I think, with just the changes he's made as a player and the offensive profile he's had. And then Bo Bichette, because like the versatility that this team has, being able to move somebody like Tommy Edman around. You know, if they could get Bo Bichette, and I think that's somebody, because he's younger, there might be some more options of how they could approach that kind of situation. But he's someone that I think, even going back to the winter meetings for me, it was another one of these situations where, okay, like you said, there's only so many teams for all these guys to kind of find a spot in. And if not enough of them are willing to go long term, you're going to probably end up with a guy or two that doesn't have a chair to sit in when the music stops. And that's where a team like the Dodgers could kind of factor in. It's similar to how they got Edwin Diaz. And it makes this whole game kind of interesting, because I think all the teams are also kind of looking at each other right now too, saying, okay, who's really going to be aggressive? Who's going to try to go out and make the kind of offer to get one of these guys without having to play this game? And for right now, we're kind of stuck in this situation where until somebody wants to be aggressive and make a move that shakes up this market a little bit, they're all just kind of circling and waiting to see what's going to happen.
The other dynamic is the fact that Bellinger and Bregman, not only are they Boris, but they've already done this. And they're also older. And so relative to Tucker and Bichette, right? And so it's a little bit harder to envision Bellinger or Bregman settling for the kind of deal that they've already just kind of had. Bregman in particular, who literally just did this last year and already opted out. Clearly, he's prioritizing trying to know where he's going to be long term, whereas Tucker or Bichette, it's easier to rationalize as they're a little bit younger, like especially in Bichette's case. But I mean, you could argue for both of them. Both of them are capable of putting up an even better season and maybe opting out and getting a longer term deal. I don't know. I think both of them are awesome, and I'd just pay either of them whatever they're looking for, this is really more from the perspective of a team like the Mets. Or maybe you could argue the Dodgers. I think another bigger picture with the Dodgers thing I wanted to kind of talk about with you is right, like the window that we're talking about and why they are hesitant to commit longer term to some of these other guys. You mentioned Edwin Diaz as an example of that maybe happening to them, but I would say that to me that was more of a, this is our most obvious need, and this is the best option. Yes, I think a lot of us expected it to maybe be a longer and larger contract than he ended up getting. But just going back to Diaz for a second, because that is, of course, the Dodgers' biggest move to this point, and really only move to this point with respect to, you know, bringing Mickey Rowe back, which is of course, important.
Mickey Rowe, did he? No disrespect, a Game 7 hero.
I was going to say, did he do anything? Did anything happen with him? But I do think that the Diaz one felt more like at the start of the offseason, people were kind of predicting as a possibility. But also the fact that they were able to do that quickly, and maybe for a deal that was even better than they expected, do you think that that's also made them almost kind of chill this offseason. Like, they really have done so little else. Maybe that's another way to ask this. Have you been surprised, regardless of the big guys, who we'll get back to in a second, have you been surprised by how little they've done otherwise?
No, I mean, I think coming into this offseason, like, they almost came in with a relaxed mindset, which, you know, winning back-to-back World Series probably helps you do. They were pretty clear from, like, the start of the winter. We really like the core we have. Look at the rotation. It's stacked. Look at the lineup. We think some of these guys are going to have better seasons than they did last year when they had some inconsistencies. Yeah, we could use an outfielder. Yeah, we're going to need to address the bullpen in some way. But, like, you know, if Edwin Diaz had, for example, like, gotten a 4 or 5 year offer from the Mets that was at, like, a similar salary number, the Dodgers probably wouldn't have matched that, right? Like, they were in on Devin Williams, but they didn't go all the way there to get him. So, like, they are operating from a place this winter that they feel very comfortable with the group that they have. And that's why you're seeing them kind of be patient and not feel like they need to be aggressive to go out and get somebody. And I think it has an effect on the larger market at play this winter when you do have a team like the Dodgers that is not being the instigator in a lot of this stuff, that's not being proactive, that's kind of happy to sit back and wait and see what happens. So as it pertains to what they've done this winter, I mean, honestly, signing Edwin Diaz is an even bigger move than I was kind of anticipating they do. I figured, okay, they might add a right-hander at the back of the bullpen. They might look for somebody on the trade market to round out the outfield. And that might be all they do, because they really didn't feel this offseason, especially compared to the last couple of years, the urgency to go out and make a big addition and make a big splash because of the talent they have in place.
That said, now I'm gonna turn this on you here a little bit, because as you're plugged in, you know what they're thinking, and I trust everything you just said as a genuine, you know, look into how they're approaching the offseason. But I mean, listen, man, you're part of the California Post now. If you want to step it up like Joel Sherman, you got to bring some takes, okay? And with that said, I mean, genuinely, I am curious, because another part of the, as we talk about the Dodgers, is like, do you agree with that approach? Like, when you look at how they are viewing their current outfield situation, their current core, listen, some of it is indisputable. When you got Yamamoto, Snell, and Ohtani, like, yes, obviously they have a lot of the best players in the world. But there are also parts of this roster that you can kind of look at and be like, I don't think they're very good. Like, or I don't think that Teoscar Hernandez is going to be that much better. I don't know what the plan is in the infield. I don't know how much they believe, or I should believe, in that next wave of young players, whether it's an Alex Freeland, whether it's a Dalton Rushing. And even if you do, are they going to get enough playing time for us to even find out if they're any good? And so that is what I want to throw back to you here is, like, do you agree with that approach? Is there something that you would say that you would still like to see them do? Again, moving the obviously signing Kyle Tucker would be awesome and make them way better. Same thing with Bichette, same thing with Bellinger. Moving those guys aside, we're going to get back to them in a second. Do you agree with that general approach, or do you see some weaknesses on this roster that you could actually see as maybe being a problem?
Yeah, I think that getting Diaz kind of addresses, like, the big question, okay, right? Because when you look at the lineup, there's still a lot of talent there. And yeah, like, you could definitely use another reliable kind of impact bat in the outfield, whether that's, you know, one of these free agent guys, whether it's trying to go on the trade market and get a Brandon Donovan or Stephen Kwan or maybe a Lars Nootbaar to a lesser level, although I don't know how much of an impact bat that becomes. But if had they not, like, fixed the closing situation in the back end of the bullpen, which was such a problem at their lowest points last season and was such an issue going into the postseason before Roky Sasaki emerged as, you know, surprise closer, I think you would have had questions. It was the same questions we were asking at the trade
and
deadline,
Yamamoto.
Which is yeah, that helped too.
All the starting pitchers that were pitching in relief and making us forget that their bullpen either stunk or was just literally unusable. So
but that was the critique at the trade deadline, which is, right, you know, you have this team that has this one very obvious weakness because Tanner Scott is not any good this year and Kirby Yates is not any good this year, and you're going to go into the playoffs without trying to address that. I think that kind of thinking does speak to, for as bad as they want to win every year, like, the other consideration that has always been present under an Andrew Friedman front office, which is they don't want to ever fall off the cliff. They want to keep their contention window open for as long as possible, which means sometimes they do not go all in on the short-term moves that might make that next year's team the best. That's why I'm kind of curious to see how they handle the rest of this offseason, right? Because you do have an opportunity to, like, win 3 titles in a row to cement yourself as arguably one of the greatest teams, maybe the greatest team or greatest run of all time. And you're in a place now with how this free agency is shaping up where, okay, you can't go get Kyle Tucker or Bo Bichette or Cody Bellinger on deals that, even if they're like a little longer term, aren't going to be terrible probably with how this is shaping up. And I'm going to be curious to see how disciplined they are. And like with Edwin Diaz, for example, I didn't think they were going to go beyond like a year long or maybe 2 year long contract for a reliever, given how bad the Tanner Scott experiment went last year. But they had somebody that, you know, was still somewhat within that favorable range on terms they liked, and they were aggressive to go get him. So as this hitting market continues to develop, I'd be a little surprised if they don't end up with one of these guys on a big move, or don't at least pivot to the trade market and find somebody, because I still do think that they understand, you know, the opportunity that's in front of them. Andrew Friedman was pretty direct about the strong financial position that the team is in right now, and about how, you know, if we continue to win and play well, we're going to put ourselves in an even stronger position moving forward. And given, like, I think this is kind of how they were hoping that this free agency market would shape up. So I'd be surprised if they don't end up with one of these guys, barring, you know, like the Phillies coming in and giving Bo Bichette a bigger offer, and then the Blue Jays maybe giving Kyle Tucker a bigger offer. Like, they were kind of banking this offseason on not enough other teams are going to be willing to commit super long-term deals to all these guys, and we can wind up with one of them. And to this point, that might be kind of how it's going.
Yeah. But I do want to hit the last Dodger-specific thing, and then we'll just open it up and get your ball-knowing takes about some of these other players and other teams, is the spending. You just mentioned, right, a good financial perspective. And sure, okay, you want to spend. You don't want to commit to 36-year-old Kyle Tucker. Sure, fine. Okay, I get it. Whatever. That's, most teams don't want to do that to anybody, but that's just the cost of free agency. But let's talk about that spending power, right? Because I think what is also needs to be understood about the Dodgers' financial situation is just how far ahead they are from everybody else. And I think the most clear way to understand how far ahead they are is not just, oh, wow, look, their projected payroll on Fangraphs right now is, you know, over $300 million. It's what that actually means in terms of what that cost, because it's more than that. I can't get over the fact that they paid $170 million last year in taxes. Okay. And the way that the luxury tax works is that when you're that far over, it's a higher percentage that you're paying on top of. And I think Ken Rosenthal actually just wrote about this recently, because there are a few of these teams that are considering this, including Toronto, who is now, you know, soared over $300 million, is that these contracts are essentially double, right? Now, this is not for us to start crying for these owners' pockets, but like, that's what we're talking about when you're this far over. That said, is there any sort, because even if you get Kyle Tucker on a short-term deal that you want, that is going to be a high AAV that is pushing your short-term payroll to something that is just so, so ridiculous. But they seem to be the only team with no actual hesitation about that element, which is how much we're paying right now because of what they're bringing in, because of the deferrals. I think that's also a big part of this. But talk a little bit about that level of financial, you know, willingness to push beyond it, because that's something that it seems like even Toronto, even Philadelphia, certainly even the Yankees are being hesitant about, even in the short term.
Yeah, there's basically with the Dodgers the before Ohtani time and the after, and that's what makes their situation so unique, right? Like, with, like, they defer a lot of money, but it's the Ohtani contract that puts them in this position that I don't think we've ever seen a team in before. Because yeah, you talk about like $170 million in taxes, but a lot of that gets counterbalanced by the fact that Ohtani's only getting $2 million and is deferring $68 million every year and is driving, you know, he's getting paid $2 million. He's probably driving 50 times that amount in just the revenue boost that, and that's a conservative guess with the revenue boost and everything else that comes along with having him on your team. You couple that with the fact that you have an ownership group, and that's why, like, that Andrew Friedman quote I mentioned earlier was interesting to me from this winter, because it speaks to the fact that, to the credit of this Guggenheim group that owns the Dodgers, they do look at the big picture here. And they look at the fact that, yeah, we're going to spend a lot of money on payroll year to year. We're going to spend a lot of money in luxury tax. But we're also, if we think, if we keep winning, right, we can charge more for tickets. We can charge more for TV deals. We can sell more merchandise. We're, you know, they have a fan club in Japan now that people pay to be a part of. And the more we win and do that, then the better position we'll be in long term, not to even mention whatever the value of the franchise is at now. And so to have somebody in Ohtani that is such an economic driving force, who's making virtually no money in the present, coupled with a team that was already, when they got him, in position to win, right? Like, it's not like when Steve Cohen took over the Mets and there was a lot of investment that was needed. Like when they got Ohtani, like, they were ready to be a World Series, like, repeat champion dynasty kind of team. And so it's put them in a place now where their only real limitation is, like you said, like, they don't want to end up with a lot of bad money on their books on contracts for players who are going to be in their late 30s at some point, right? Like, they're already going to be looking at Mookie Betts, who has 7 years left. Like, that's not going to be a good contract at some point, most likely. When it comes to, like, the Kyle Tucker thing specifically, you know, they look at their farm system. They have like 5 or 6 outfielders that they really 15. Like right now.
Yeah. Like, it's so, an absurd group. And that's a big kind of big picture question for them in the next couple of years. Yeah.
Yeah. And they look at that and they say, okay, we're going to, you know, 3 to 5 years from now, we're going to have at least a couple outfielders from that group that we like. So we don't want to give Kyle Tucker, you know, sure, a deal where in 5 years from now, he's blocking a spot for one of these guys. So that's really the only limitation. But when it comes to short-term spending, my favorite example was when they signed Kirby Yates last year. When they signed Kirby Yates, it was like a $13 million deal. But like you said, it's really like worth double. So that was almost 30. And then to get him on the roster, they had to get rid of Ryan Brazier and eat his salary. They ended up spending like almost $35 million on Kirby Yates for 1 year. And he wasn't even any good last year and was hurt for the postseason. But they can do that because in the short term, the same thing like spending $17 million on Michael Conforto. Year to year, short-term salaries, they are making so much money right now that it's almost like risk-free investments for sure them. And that's why this winter, this is, for at least them, that's the impetus for why they prefer these shorter-term deals so much, because they know they have the money right now that even if they miss on a couple guys, it's not going to hurt them.
Totally. The last thing to point out about this, though, and then we'll bounce back to these other guys and then we'll send it to my conversation with Lance, is that, like, the one other looming wild card is the next CBA. And I mention that because if the structure of the economics of baseball changes, and I'm not even talking about a salary cap, because I'm going to exist as long as I can in a world where I don't believe that was ever going to happen. But what is something that is totally realistic is that the punishments for the luxury tax become even more extreme.
500% things that even Guggenheim would have to
that's what I'm thinking about as like a much more realistic thing, which so far, to your point, has still not deterred them because they don't actually know what that's going to be. And for now, especially for 2026, you're trying to go, you know, back to back to back, as you should, because that's the point. You would hope for every team, but especially for a team in their position, when you have these multiple Hall of Famers in their 30s, when you don't know how much longer you're going to have these players be great. And that includes Freddie Freeman. That includes Mookie Betts. I guess that includes Ohtani, although presumably he'll just be amazing forever. But yeah, so I think that's all very fair. And I think a good insight into just like the unique financial position that they are in. So let's just bounce around again, just to take off your Dodgers beat writer cap now and just look around as someone who covers the sport and has watched these players. Like, do you have any strong opinions about where these players fit best? I mean, I guess I'll just open it up and just be like, listen, the general consensus that we've heard so far, right, is that the Blue Jays are considering Tucker and Bichette. The Red Sox are considering Bregman and Bichette. The Yankees seem to really only be considering Bellinger. We get some reporting from Brendan Cuddy of The Athletic that they have up their offer $30 million in AAV, but the, you know, Boris and Bellinger are still looking for 7 years. Are they interested in Bichette? And now you have this interesting report about the Phillies interesting in Bichette, which I love that fit. I saw that as one, even with the roster machinations that they clearly feel like they need to address if they do sign him. By the way, that's another example. You know, you see the reporting and being like, the Phillies cannot sign Bichette and Real Muto. Why not? Like, they could, but clearly there's a financial right level where they're like, no, we're only comfortable doing this. We're going to have to move Bohm around, maybe move Stott to third, so on and so forth. Of the developments that we've had in the last week or so, including non-Dodgers teams, what has maybe raised your eyebrows about, you know, certain team connections, and maybe how do you see this shaking out?
I mean, the Bichette Phillies thing has been the most interesting thing to me. A, because that's the kind of development that could kind of shake up this stasis that we're in, yeah, and start actually leading to
and
guys
the expectations,
getting signed.
right? And yeah, the, like, well, where we thought teams might, where guys could fit going into it, because now you might have multiple teams ending up with not, with none of these guys.
Yeah. And this one has some layers, right? Like, is this just a bluff to try to get things moving with JT Realmuto? Is it a situation that they approach where they really want Bichette and they're going to get him, even if they're not certain they can do the other moves that might be required to free up the payroll space? Or do they need to make sure they can do that before they really make a serious run at him? Obviously, there's the Don Mattingly tie. The thing that's interesting to me about that is, you know, being around that NLDS last year with the Phillies loss to the Dodgers, there was this such as overriding mood on the Philly side that it was a window closing, right? That it was the beginning of the end for this team. And for as good as JT Realmuto is and as important as he is, I think it just like the culture of that team and obviously what he means to that pitching staff. You know, I think if you look at it as a fellow contender in the National League, if the Phillies were to get Bo Bichette, especially coming off the season he just had, suddenly doesn't feel like the window's closing quite as fast on them and gives them the kind of lineup balance that maybe they were missing last year, especially once you got beyond some of the bigger names at the top of it. So that one's really interesting to me. I think Kyle Tucker going to Toronto, like the way the Blue Jays have operated to this point, you finish a perfect offseason if you get him, right? And honestly, like if you let Bichette go, like you probably save some money by getting an Okamoto instead, which was another kind of interesting development to me because, you know, up to that point, there was at least somewhat of a possibility that the Blue Jays could try to get Tucker and Bichette. But I think him going there fits for a lot of different reasons. And that's the kind of team that, you know, if you're Toronto and you got so close last year, and it's probably the team that's been operating closest to the Dodgers, which is, you know, hey, we made a deep postseason run. We got all this extra revenue from the playoffs. Like I think I saw their, you know, their team president or the president of Rogers say it was like $100 million boon for them. How, like, that's a team that recognized success is going to beget more success, especially if we continue to reinvest. So I think that's what makes sense there. I think it would still be surprising if Bregman doesn't go back to the Red Sox, even though, mm-hmm. boy, the D-backs love sneaking their way in.
Sure.
Things the most unexpected of ways.
Sure.
And then Bellinger to the Yankees, you know, still also seems like the likeliest outcome there. I do wonder if the Mets get in at some point with any of these guys.
Mets are the one. It's like how long we've talked about it all offseason, right? It's a David Stearns versus Steve Cohen. At some point, Steve Cohen might just decide to wake up and pay one of these guys. Like he's the owner in the best position to just blow Kyle Tucker away if he's interested in doing so. You know, whether David Stearns thinks that's a good idea, we're probably never going to know. But if Steve Cohen decides he wants to do it, then that is very, very possible. And that's also why bringing it back to the Dodgers, this is why they're in such a good position. There's no pressure. All these other teams have pressure to land at least one of these guys in a way that if they don't, it will feel like a failure. I think saying that about the Blue Jays is pretty funny, considering they've already spent well over $300 million and have already gotten Dilatsis and Okamoto and so on and so forth. But that's clearly the case with Boston. It is clearly the case with the Yankees. And I think it's clearly the case with the Mets, right? The Phillies are a little bit different because they've already done some stuff. And like everything you said about Bichette is true. I would also argue it makes more sense for Tucker. They've already spent a little bit on their outfield with Adolis Garcia. That was the natural fit. Was Tucker more than Bichette, right? That would require fewer moving parts involving the infield. But I agree. And I just love Bo. I just think like it's kind of sad that I think it'd be perfect for Boston too. I think that if Bregman does leave, I think Bichette would be perfect for Boston. So we will see. And by the way, also for the Dodgers. I think second base, if you look at really what is a weak spot right now, I know they have Kim there. They could play Edmund. In theory, they believe in Freeland, who's a top prospect and could play that position. But I think he would fit there too. So we will see how it shakes out. And yeah, I guess the report from Gelb is that the Phillies are meeting with Bo next week. So maybe that spurs some action. But you make a really good point that it could all be related and just trying to nudge Realmuto. It could be trying to nudge Bichette. It could be like there's so many different versions of this that we could see. But all right.
Or yeah, Don Mattingly is inserting himself as a main character in the baseball offseason, which would be a great subplot to this.
Which, like, are Don Mattingly and Bo Bichette homies? Probably. is that really going to be wise with the Phillies?
Hey, man, don't wreck a great narrative.
Oh, it's not going to stop people from writing it, but my goodness, that would be something. And by the way, that would also be another fascinating one because it would necessitate other moves for the Phillies, not just those for those other free agents. What is happening with Stott? What is happening with Bohm? What is happening with Real Muto? Because, okay, if he's not going back to the Phillies, where is he going? And who's catching for the Phillies? Is Rafael Marchand and Garrett Stubbs really plan A, or are we traded for someone else? You know, so there are a lot of big questions with all these guys. And hopefully by the time Jake's back, we will have a little bit more clarity. But for now, we're going to take a break. When we return, you will hear my conversation with Lance Brozdowski talking Ever Cabrera. And then Jack's going to return for a little good, bad, and ugly. We'll be right back on Baseball Barbcast. Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. I am now thrilled to be joined by Lance Brozdowski of the Marquee Sports Network, Marquee's own Lance Brozdowski. And I got to say, Lance, it's kind of nice. I got you all to myself. You know, last time I had you on, I had to make sure Jake wasn't around. And now it's just like more time to talk to my buddy Lance. So thanks for coming on. We got an actual news peg. It's not just because Jake's on vacation and I wanted you to fill in. The Cubs did something and you get like to talk about the Cubs, right? Not like you're paid to talk about the Cubs. So welcome back to Baseball Barbacast.
Thanks for having me. Second time, feeling better. This is like you get sent down after not doing well. You get called back up and you're like, no, I remember the pitching. Like I remember they're gonna attack me a little differently. So I'm in. I'm ready.
Well, I think this is not why it took several months for you to come back. I would love to make you a regular staple here, and maybe we will moving forward. But this was a perfect assignment for you, right? The Cubs acquiring an interesting pitcher with a lot of upside and a lot of question marks. So for those of you, of course, who've not really seen the details of the deal, just to review, the Cubs acquire right-handed pitcher Edward Cabrera from the Miami Marlins for three hitting prospects, most notably Owen Casey, an outfielder who made his major league debut in 2025, and two lower-level players, Christian Hernandez and Edgardo De Leon. But we're going to focus on Cabrera and Casey in this conversation. And I think that, as I mentioned, like you spent a lot of time thinking and talking and writing and yapping about pitching. And Edward Cabrera is just like the perfect kind of pitcher for modern pitching discourse, right? For so many reasons. There's so many things going on with him that could make you love him or hate him. And so let's get into the positives, right? We are going to get into some reasons for either skepticism or concern, but let's stay positive here. Why would any team, because apparently a lot of teams were interested in trading for Edward Cabrera, what is exciting about this pitcher?
The stuff. Yeah, it's the stuff. I mean, we've heard this term a ton. You're comboing up release and velo and how the ball moves and coming up with like a singular number to grade the guy's ability to miss bats, which is one of the most predictive things for success. So that's it. Like, he does a really good job of this. And Fail Territory was joking about me. They were like, is he the smartest kid in the dumb school? Because like the Cubs don't have a lot of stuff. And I was like, I think he's smart kid in that school, but also this cool, he's cool if you send him to like Stanford. He can like get B's there. You know what I mean?
Sure, sure.
So I think he's a great pitcher. Like he creates nasty breaking ball shapes. He's got a hard fastball. He's got this wacky changeup that's really hard. And I think the big thing to notice is like year over year, he finally improved the walk rate. This is huge. Like, I think this is sticky. I don't think the prior Marlins regime did a great job of optimizing his usage. And I think there's like a variety of ways you can improve command, although all of them are like kind of, no one's going to be like, I can totally get this guy's command better. But I'd say the most reliable way to do it is to get the guy on a pitch that he can zone more and is more comfortable throwing. They lowered his slot or his slot fell. I don't think it was intentional from what I've been talking to people about. So the slot falls, the sinker gets a little better from a quality standpoint, and they go, hey, throw that thing a bunch because you're actually better at zoning it than your four-seam. You see four-seam come down versus lefties and righties, sinker shoot up, throwing more breaking balls. All of a sudden, the walk rate's at 8% with a potential for like a high 20 strikeout rate. I mean, it's really easy to project him as like an impact, let's say like two or three in a rotation. I don't think he's ace level. You know, I don't think he's a square two. Like he's probably in that 2-3 window. He's a really good pitcher. Really fun stuff.
Yeah. And especially in relation to, as you kind of joked about earlier, but it is relevant, the other pitchers in the Cubs rotation, right? And why they were seeking rotation upgrades to begin with, you know, where exactly he slots in is probably also going to depend on how those other pitchers are pitching, but also how he does. I think what's fun to me about Cabrera is you know, if you follow Lance, you read his work, you know, you watch his YouTube videos, or not just Lance, right? Like a lot of people now in the pitching analysis space, whether we're talking about stuff plus models and just how we're grading pitches, sometimes it's not actually obvious what you're watching. Maybe you're watching a pitcher and you're reading that someone like Lance or Eno Saris is being like, this guy has his stuff plus, he loves his curveball or loves his slider. And you watch the guy and you're like, okay, I don't really get it. Not an issue with Edward Cabrera. Again, this is true for a lot of guys that throw really hard. But if you tune into an Edward Cabrera start where he's, you know, got his stuff going, it's very obvious that this guy can create some really incredible just aesthetic shapes. Forget what exactly the StatCast is telling you about what it's moving. I mean, just watch, right? Just watch the curveball. Just watch the changeup that averages 94 miles an hour. Just watch two different fastballs that, when he is zoning them, can be really effective. I want to talk about that sinker, though, because as you mentioned, that clearly helped him get back in the zone and lower a walk rate that had been over 10% for his entire career. The other thing about Edward Cabrera, we talk about what has prevented him from reaching his potential. We're going to talk about the injuries in a second because that's very relevant in terms of the sample size. But this is a long time of having big stuff. This dude hit 100 when he was a teenager. That was almost a decade ago. And as you mentioned, the Marlins regime, the Marlins have also developed a lot of pitchers. It took a really, really long time for him to finally put it all together. And you can say that that's maybe a good thing or a bad thing based on how much he improved in 2025. But the reason why I bring up that sinker is because people in this space will also point to that pitch and be like, well, hey, if I pull up on StatCast and I look at all these pitches performed, that sinker's getting crushed. That fastball's still not performing well, right? So when you look at the mix, beyond just moving away from a four-seamer that he clearly could not command at all, what else could you maybe, and knowing the tendencies of how the Cubs like to optimize pitchers, what are some other things you could maybe see with them if he can, you know, stay on the mound and make 30 starts? What are some other tweaks to the pitch mix that you could see kind of elevating his overall performance?
Yeah, I'll speak to this sans Cubs for a second, then I'll incorporate the Cubs perspective because I think it's two different things. And talking to people, the obvious two angles here is there's probably a sweeper in here if he wants it, and there's probably a cutter of some kind. So we're getting to this trend. We saw it a ton last year. David Adler had a really good piece in MLB.com about it. Just everyone's throwing more pitches. And we're understanding so much about seam effects and how airflow around the ball can influence movement that every dude can throw six pitches, especially if you're able to get to the side of the ball relatively well and have high spin capacity and cut the ball a little bit, which Cabrera can do a little. So in that respect, you can push him to a cut in a sweep. I actually think he threw a cutter a couple times. I haven't been able to back check it. I was talking to someone that said that he threw it in an outing a couple times. So it's there. He's thrown it. Perhaps that's something you just elevate and push up. The interesting part of this is that the Cubs last year had the highest four-seam fastball usage in all of Major League Baseball. They also had the highest 3-2 strike zone rate. They are a count-leverage team that is comfortable throwing things directly in the zone and giving up barrels because at Wrigley Field, a lot of those times, those barrels don't get out. It's a philosophical thing that I believe I don't know if they explicitly said, but you can read between the lines and look at every single one of their starting pitchers.
Yeah, and it's also pretty obvious. When your defense is this good and when PCA can run down, you know, blistering line drives into the gap because you threw a fastball down the middle, I know that's a sort of simplifying things, but pitching and defense,
it's
a not just pitching and defense, it's pitching plus defense, right? It's not, the pitching has been designed to work in tandem with the defense in a lot of respects.
I think so. And the 100%. Ballpark. I agree entirely. I think that's and they do it really well. It's not a critique. It's just it's a differentiator. It's something that's different about them, which I always love pointing out. With Cabrera, he would be by far the lowest four-seam sink combine those two usages together. How much do you throw those pitches? He's around, I think, 35% last year. Pretty much every single Cubs starter the last like 3 years is like 55% or greater, as long as you like play with the classification on cutters. Like all these dudes just rip fastballs in the zone, you know, like they're trying to get ahead. So I'm fascinated to see what the Cubs do specifically with Cabrera, because I think perhaps if I had to bet, I would say the four seam and sink usage combined goes up slightly. But I would hope that they push towards the cut and the sweep and really get the mix bigger alongside that, such that you start to turn them into like, yeah, we could get his walk rate down to 7% or 6.5% because he's actually even in zone more now to pre-2K because of what he's mixing. From a fastball standpoint, we're having him throw a little more than 35%. There's also the other, like if he went to the Red Sox, who I think were a team that was roughly interested in him, he would throw zero fastball. This dude would be throwing 55% slider in all accounts, you know? So it's like, it's interesting to see his fit on the Cubs and think about that relative to other teams.
And so by the way, also, this is a big part of acquiring a pitcher with 3 years of team control, right? Like, maybe it doesn't all come together in 2026, but you can still work with him and understand what he is capable of and what's working and what pitchers maybe he does have more command over if you are going to, you know, up the usage of them. We're going to get to the durability here in a second, because that is very important.
We're getting there.
But the last thing on his pitch mix, and it's funny you mentioned, you know, the Red Sox, oh, well, they just have him throw all secondaries or more sliders, more sweepers. The pitch that I sort of mentioned, but again, is if you just go in and what he has been doing, what has been succeeding, it's the changeup and the curveball, right? If you just look at what has performed the best, it's the changeup and the curveball. The curveball in particular has been one of the most effective curveballs in baseball. So are you saying adjust the curveball to make it more sweepy, or adjust the slider to make it more sweepy? And why is his curveball so good? I mean, you watch it, it's pretty nasty, right? But that's also a pitch that we just see less of now. There's just not, and that is a pitch usage-wise that has gone down in general across the league. So why is it worked for him, and how could you see a curveball maybe working in tandem with the sweeper, and then also the changeup, which was literally his most used pitch this past year? Where do you see that kind of factoring in?
Yeah, I think sweeper would be on top of the other breaking balls. This gets to my point about, like, everyone can now probably throw 5 or 6 pitches and be really good. The curveball is really good simply because of the combination of, I would say the simple way to look at this is just, how hard is the guy throwing it and how much movement is he creating? So you have to understand a little bit about pitch movement here. You could go to Savant and they have, like, those plots and stuff. Usually what happens is as velo jumps, the ball has less time to move. So the way we measure movement is just kind of contracts. So a lot of the time when a dude throws like 100, we're never like, I love that fastball shape. You know, it's more just like, he throws 100 and the fastball shape's good. It's like, well, yeah, the ball doesn't have time to create those 20 inches of Justin Verlander break. So with a curveball, think about it, it's just kind of inverted. It's like, as that curveball gets harder, it tends to tighten up. But his average movement profile in his curveball is greater than the average curveball at like 80 miles per hour. His is 84. So, like, that is crazy. You know what I mean? Like, you're adding 4 miles per hour, and then you're not even taking away movement. You're not shortening up the shape. You're actually extending the shape. I think it has an inch more drop and an inch more sweep than your average curveball. And it's 4 miles per hour harder. Like, that, in the most basic sense, is how, like, the OG stuff models worked. We've gotten into the land of, like, angles and a lot more variance, and makes them a little less interpretable. But the basic ones from a while ago were literally just, what's the release point? What's the velo? What's the movement? Here's a number. And as a result, that curveball is going to be like plus plus by like every model, all the old models. Maybe the new models are a little more suspect. It's very similar to Boz's curveball, actually. His is like 85, a little more verticality, but same idea. It's got a lot of drop and it's 85. So that is like why the curveball is really good. The changeup's good because it's like a weird pitch. He actually like hikes his slot a bit, which I feel like in my head makes some sense. But I also hear much more about dudes like lowering slot to create more of that like disco ball change, but he hikes his slot, and I think that's why he's able to throw it harder, and it has sinker-esque shape, just that literally like almost the same velo as a sinker. It's really hard to explain that pitch. The curveball is far easier to explain, but the change, just watch the hitter reaction, right? Like, the hitters are just like swinging right through it, and you're like, it just kind of looks okay to me, but it's 96 and it misses bats.
And the guy that was really throwing changeups like that first caught my attention was his now former teammate, Sandy. I remember 2 or 3 years ago when Sandy Alcantara was really popping and he was, you know, pumping 100, but like he was dropping in changeups at 93, 94. And it was just like, what in the world? Like, where?
The Marlins were great at this. I just think they were a little like close-minded on it, you know, where it's like, that is all we can do. And it's like, cool. But you have these other pitchers that are like, you know, like, so, Vesia goes to the Dodgers and is better, and Gallen. And there's so many other instances where they just missed on guys because they were like, throw a power change. And he's like, I can't. And they're like, go, get out of here.
So we will, again, there's plenty more to talk about where the Marlins go from here from a pitching standpoint. But you mentioned Shane Boz there. And I have also just been thinking about him, right? Because we saw the return that Tampa got for him. Both of these guys, I mean, Boz is about a year younger, maybe a little less than a year younger than Cabrera. But you compare these two guys over the last 2 years, and it's a very similar workload, and Cabrera's arguably been better. Boz just made it through a full season healthy. Now, he also has his own injury history, right? But let's talk about the red flags with Cabrera, right? Because if you are wondering maybe why he didn't get as much as Boz in return, although we can talk about how Casey's value being closer to the big leagues is probably a big part of that compared to the 4 A-ball players that the Rays got plus the draft pick. I do think that with Cabrera, and when you compare him to Boz, by the way, the other thing about him too is, right, is like, yes, he just had a good, interesting season, but you're also projecting a lot. You're seeing the stuff and you're saying, oh, what can we do with him, right? That's what Baltimore's saying. Now, in both of these cases, it's kind of funny because both the Marlins and Rays have generally had success developing pitchers in different respects, you know, in slightly different ways. Obviously, the Cubs and Orioles think they can get more out of them. Back to Cabrera's elbow slash shoulder slash whatever else is going on with him. While yes, you can say, hey, well, wait a minute. Yeah, he had an elbow sprain in September, but he came back. He pitched at the end of the season. When we talk about medical records, okay, you have to go through, teams have to approve the medicals. Sometimes that's a very opaque process. And when you're looking at a player's injury history based on how many times he's been on the injury list, you're like, well, what are we talking about here? Like, this is kind of more behind the scenes stuff that we are not always privy to as journalists, but also just as fans, right? In this case, there's no secret. Edward Cabrera missed a lot of time, has been on the injured list multiple times for both elbow and shoulder injuries in four consecutive years, right? It was basically since he debuted in 21, it was elbow in 22, shoulder in 23, shoulder in 24, and then again elbow in 25. He's never, you know, he just set a career high in innings, which is encouraging. I mean, listen, when we talk about predicting future injury, it's clearly a fickle beast. But also, what you hear is past injury predicts future injury more than as much as we can. Add in the context of a year ago, the Cubs spiking a trade with this same team, the Marlins, reportedly to acquire Jesus Luzardo, who goes on to have a fully healthy, successful season with the Phillies. That does not mean that Edward Cabrera is about to get hurt or that he's about to throw 300 innings.
But that'd be crazy.
That'd be something. But I bring all that dimension, just like, what have you heard about this? And do you sense that this has kind of factored into the calculus for maybe both teams in this decision to make this trade?
To answer your question, I think it is. It's a particularly weird spot because we have literal reports that he has a sprain in his UCL from last September. Like, it's out there. It's on MLB.com, the league's website. It says he sprained his UCL, which is a tear. Sprain is a tear, which people often miss up. How quickly those things heal? Is it a precursor to anything? Like, I have no clue. What I'm going off of is the fact that in talking to people, not in either of these organizations, the league was a little bit hesitant around the medicals with him. I'm not saying like those individuals like looked at the medicals, because it always seems like it happens once the trade gets far enough down the road or is like accepted and blah, blah, blah. But it's, you got to read between the lines here. Like, the Yankees were like gonna get him and then poof. And the Cubs were like gonna get him. Then we had like a 4-hour wait yesterday where it was just like, I was calling people, trying to text people like, is this happening? What's the return? I was like, I kind of had the return. I was like, I need to get it confirmed. Did you tell the guys? Because I don't want to be like tweeting that Owen Casey's gone. And he's I haven't been told yet. You know,
Owen Casey, we're going to get to a second. But also, it's funny because you're like, am I about to be really busy for the rest of the week? Because the Cubs
just made a break. My day was shot like yesterday. And I didn't even accomplish anything yesterday. I just like was sitting there like waiting for people to text me, wondering if like, maybe I have a scoop here. This is cool. I don't usually get these. But
all that said, I do think it is an important point here, right? Because you might say, well, he came back and pitched. What's the big deal?
Exactly.
I think something that we've learned, though, in recent years with elbow injuries is like, one, there's clearly a huge range of pain tolerance for all kinds of pitchers. And there are often times where we just find out that guys have just been pitching through this for either entire seasons or full seasons. And so it's like the fact that he came back and made two starts is by no means telling me that he's okay. It tells me something, because clearly they didn't say you need to have surgery right now, which in theory could have been something that happened, right? And sometimes would have been, right? So in some ways we'll say we'll never know, but this is an undeniable part of this story that does not require any sort of behind the scenes information, because his history is what it is.
And that's why we're talking about it. If this was not something that was ever reported, I would never remotely bring this up. Like, it's just like, I don't care. Like, to me, medical stuff is like a Rorschach test.
100%.
Like, it seems like anybody could look at it from the medical team in any organization and flag something they don't like. These dudes are throwing 97 miles per hour. Right. Everyone hurts. Everyone's broken in some respect. But the fact that we have a verified sprain from him last year and we're only like 4 months removed from that, I think went into the calculus. I can't confirm this, but yeah, again, reading between the lines, reading the tea leaves, it had to have gone into the calculus on the Cubs side for the risk tolerance in this situation. Yep. You know, if you think back to when they were discussing this right around the deadline, which is right around when this injury happened, I wonder if the ask was higher. Like, maybe the name that I heard the Cubs were not really willing to part with in a variety of iterations of deals, I don't know if it was specifically the Cabrera one, was Jackson Williams. They didn't want to give up this big righty they have that is by far the best pitching prospect in their org. You could argue literally like the only pitching prospect in their organization. They didn't want to part with him. They didn't want to part with him for anybody, whether it be Joe Ryan or Mike Hensig or any of these other guys. From my understanding, the packages being proposed were all like Wiggins is the name we're a little bit hesitant on because we don't have any other pitching. So maybe the ask went from Wiggins, Casey down to just Casey and these peripheral pieces. You know, like I really don't know exactly, but like you have to wonder what the negotiations look like at the deadline and what they look like these last 3 days before this trade happened and whether that injury caused the package to drop a little. It's definitely a factor in this one, man. Yes. Like this isn't something that you can just gloss over. Like we were talking about the draft. The draft is the worst with medicals to the point where last year, if you noticed, I did some stuff for MLB Network. I picked all the dudes who were hurt because I was like, listen, no one can tell me anything about these medicals. Every team has a different opinion. Gage Wood, Riley Quick, like, you know what? I don't care. They throw absolute shed and have awesome shapes. I'm betting on them. And everyone's like, well, you're picking all the injured guys. And I was like, do you know they're injured? No one can tell me whether they're injured. So like that stuff I'm going to stay away from entirely. But again, we're going back to the point where like we have it. He's got a sprain. The UCL's torn. How long can he pitch with it? I have absolutely no idea. Can he magically heal it in an offseason? Perhaps he can. Like we got to keep Meister on here or something. Like
well,
I don't
when
know
we
how
talk
you,
about – probably not. It would be an interesting
podcast.
Probably
not, maybe.
I will say, and listen, that's probably not a pitcher you want to trade for if he's got a year of club control left, right? But
exactly. That's
part
a great
of the
point.
Calculus
yes.
might be the Cubs saying, you know what? Maybe he does need elbow surgery in March. And while the optics would be terrible if he immediately gets hurt, undeniably, they still can say, you know what? He could come back at the end of 27.
Correct.
And so on, so on. So anyway.
I think that's 100% in it for the Cubs.
That also
no
has to be part of this, right?
Absolutely.
All that said, well, as we close here with you here in a few minutes, they did trade a pretty important prospect for them in Owen Casey.
They did, yeah.
You know, a player who not only is like highly ranked and has a lot of minor league success, was projected to maybe play an important role on their major league team in 2026. And now he is a Miami Marlin. Joining a very fun young outfield with Jacob Marcy, Kyle Stowers, two other trade acquisitions.
Yep, Bendix
the
cooking, man. Bendix's league.
Who have flourished with the fish. Having followed Owen Casey, again, we don't have to go too deep on him, but because he is the important part of this deal, like with all due respect to Hernandez and DeLeon, who might turn into something but have a lot to prove, Casey is like, this is a belief that Owen Casey can be a big part of the Marlins. Also, not just right now, but like a part of their solution as they look to add more offense. Having followed him and following Cub prospects, what's your optimism level for Owen Casey moving forward?
Yeah, I think he's good. I think that if you're asking me which of the two I would rather trade between an Owen Casey and a Moises Ballesteros, I think I would trade Mo because I just don't think the positional versatility there lends itself to putting up large WAR numbers. Now, I do think Moises Ballesteros is a better hitter presently. So if you're asking me in the next 2 years who provides more WRC+, it's probably Moises Ballesteros. The problem is that I don't see Ballesteros not DHing at the major league level. You know, Casey can play right field. I think he's got a decent arm. He's pretty mobile out there. He's improved that, I think, in the last couple of years as well. The big thing is just he impacts the ball really hard. Like, this is just exit velocity stuff. Like, he looks great in those metrics, swings really hard. The K rate's going to be high. The big thing, we're going back to, like, the calculus point maybe around, like, why the Cubs would do this trade. If they don't think he ever comes out of platoon land, then yeah, like that's a limited profile, you know? If he's like an average defender and he just can never hit lefties, so you just always end up subbing him out, like, yeah, it's not that great of a player. So, you know, like even if he hits like 35 homers or like a 30% strikeout rate and he plays average defense and he plays 110 games, let's say, gets like 450 plate appearances, like I think 140 innings of Edward Cabrera is surpassing that if Cabrera is like healthy and on the mound and looks remotely like he does. So like that calculus I get, you know, but I do think Owen Casey's good. I think he will be an impact bat on that team for an extended period of time. Maybe it takes a little for him to warm in. And if he never gets out of platoon land, I still think he could be a pretty good hitter. So I like him. I think he was tough to part with. And he was, to me, the logical Kyle Tucker replacement. Like you don't have him, your probability of being a top 10 offense is not good. Like, I think they were the 8th best offense last year by some metrics, or I was looking at the Blue Jays and I saw the Cubs right next to them. So they were in that vicinity of top 10. I think it's hard to project the Cubs as a top 10 offense right now. I just don't really see it. Like, you need Tucker. You had a bunch of health last year. You had really, really good seasons from Michael Bush and Seiya Suzuki. Now Seiya Suzuki is playing 150 games in right field at present, and you can't guarantee the health of everybody else. Like, does Pete have another April, May, half of June in him that looked like last year, or is it more stable production? Like, there's a lot. I think this offense is good. It's not a bad offense, but it posting top five numbers for months on end is predicated a bit, I think, on Tucker being in there and health. So I'm waiting to see what the next move is here. Like, I don't know what it is. I know they're linked on Bregman. That makes a lot of sense. My gut is the Red Sox are just going to outbid whoever is even remotely close to the price range. Bellinger reunion makes sense. Yankees, Heyman said that's the Yankees' number one target. Reunion with Tucker is unlikely. So, like, there's no other impact bat that gets them, that claws back what they just lost in Casey. Perhaps they think Seiya and Wright by Steros at DH is a better offense, which I roughly agree with. But again, we're a year removed from them saying they don't want Seiya in right field all the time. And what happened last year? He didn't play right field. He was an incredible hitter for, like, the entire season. It worked. Like, literally, what they wanted worked. So now you're putting him back out there. I struggle a little with assuming he's as good of a hitter. You put him back on his feet for 150 games. Like, I don't know, man. Like, I'm a little bit skeptical that's the outcome we're going to.
You're asking all the right questions, and that's why I have nothing to add, because there is a lot of offseason left, and we will see if they have another move to make an offense. Lance, do you have a couple minutes to do one more topic, or do we want to?
We're going to talk Rockies quick. I'll stay for the Rockies.
Let's do this quickly. We're going to do this quickly, and then we're going to let you go. The Rockies signed Michael Lorenzen. We don't have to talk about Michael Lorenzen specifically, but if I have a smart pitching person on here and we finally have the Rockies signing a free agent starting pitcher, maybe it's about Lorenzen, maybe it's about their new hires. Do you have any big picture thoughts about what the new brain Rockies are going to attempt this year? Not because they're suddenly going to go for a World Series, but what would you like to see maybe from an experimental side in terms of pitching and cores now that we have a little bit of new IQ in the building?
I think I got the answers. I think it's not throwing as many fastballs and throwing more of everything else. And I think it's really that simple. Like, I was talking to someone from their org the other day, and I was like, tell me how to solve. I asked him, like, how do you solve cores? Like, what do you think? Like, what is it? You know? And he's like, listen, I don't actually think it's solving cores right now. I think it's more, we need to just do, like, the baseline things that a good pitching org does. Like, they're so far behind the curve that, like, you bring all these people
there,
in.
And then
we're just trying to get them back to average, you know?
Totally.
Because, like, you look at their road pitching stats last year. Like, they were awful. So it's not just cores. It's that they were not good at pitching development.
Exactly.
Pitching.
Well
so
said.
That
well
you just got to correct that. Like, if you are the same offense, same pitching staff, excuse me, at home, you still suck. You're terrible. But the road stats go back to 15th best in the league. That's a huge win, in my opinion. So I really think the first thing they do this year is literally just stop throwing so much ball and play at home. Give me more sliders. Give me more splits. Give me everything that isn't as affected as much by the altitude. Yeah. Push velo a ton when necessary, because that's the only way you're going to protect the bad shapes that happen at Coors because of the altitude. And I think that's, like, step A. And I think that's literally going to take, like, a full season to implement. That's 100%. It. That's literally it. And we go from there. We'll see next season, like, oh, yeah, look, they were 24th worst. They weren't the worst, as they've been for the last, I think, three seasons. That'd be a massive step, in my opinion. Because they were god-awful on the pitching side last year, man.
Well, guess what?
Oh, my God.
Mike Lorenzen throws a bunch of pitches. So hopefully
he
throws fewer fastballs, and we wish him the best. And I think from a personality standpoint, Michael Lorenzen seems like the perfect kind of guy to, like, embrace the challenge.
Yeah.
So I'm excited for that. Thank you for giving us this little bonus, Lance, there. But we appreciate the time. Lance Przezdowski of Marquee. He is one of the best in the business. Go subscribe to his YouTube channel. Watch whatever clip comes on the timeline where Lance is yapping. Watch it. You're going to learn something. I promise. Lance, thank you so much for the time, man. And we'll have you back on here at the Barbercast soon.
Let's do it. I love the hat, too. I forgot to point that out.
Of course. Shout out to the iCups.
See you, man.
Welcome back to Baseball Barbercast. Thanks again to Lance Przezdowski for giving us his Edward Cabrera thoughts. Jack Harris, you are back for Baseball Barbercast. And one of the best things about inviting Jack on to co-host with me is that Jack listens to the pod enough to know that we have some bits that we love to run back. And Jack, you get to join us for really the two, really the only two bits that matter most. And that is the Scott Boras scoreboard and Good, Bad, and Ugly. Let's begin with another update for the Scobo, the Scott Boras scoreboard, where all offseason long, we keep track of all happenings involving super agent Scott Boras and give him a win, draw, or a loss involving whatever it is that he's doing, whether that's signing a contract, whether that's making a bad joke, whether that's getting Tatsuya Imai to wear all Boras gear to the Houston Texans game. All of this is eligible for the Scobo. The latest installment, my friend, comes to us via the arbitration filing deadline, which arrived on Thursday.
The most boring day in the baseball offseason. The most exciting subplots.
The timeline is just a mess of numbers that are important, but also aren't actually that interesting, involving what salaries teams are making or team players are making.
The most tedious day.
Tedious is the perfect day for it.
Better word.
However, in this case, we had a great subplot. Not subplot, the plot, because everything else is a subplot to Tarek Skubal. And that is Tarek Skubal in his final year under contract. As the way the system works, where players and teams say, all right, what salary are you going to make this year? Players say, I should make this. Teams say, you should make this. And 90% of the time, the teams and players are like, yeah, we'll figure it out. We'll settle. Okay, great. Yes, you'll make $7.8 million. Oh, okay, great. You'll make $10.1 million. Oh, you'll make $900K. However, in the case of Tarek Skubal, coming off consecutive Cy Youngs, it is no surprise that he and the Detroit Tigers have a slightly different perception of what he deserves to be paid in 2026.
Slightly.
Just a little. And by slightly, I mean a $13 million difference, as Tarek Skubal and his agent Scott Boras have filed for a $32 million salary in 2026, which would be by far the highest salary for any starting pitcher in his final year of ARB. But not just any starting pitcher, any player ever, because Juan Soto holds the record for the highest salary in his final arbitration year at $31 million. No surprise, Scott Boras. But here we have Tarek Skubal, already a main character this offseason amidst trade rumors, filing for $32 million, where the Detroit Tigers have offered $19 million. And in a lot of cases, you see they figure it out because they were close enough and they meet in the middle. This is not a thing that was going to be worked out yesterday before the deadline. And so here we have Tarek Skubal and Scott Boras asking for $32 million. That is what we are grading here. Is this ask, which is so far and away beyond what any pitcher in Tarek Skubal's position has ever been paid, is this attempt, which is now going to go to a hearing, likely, they could still settle at some point before then, although based on the gap, that sure seems unlikely. A reminder of how this system works. If this does go to a hearing, it will go to a panel of three, you know, neutral party arbitrators. They will decide. It's based on the midpoint. And so the midpoint between these two filings being $25.5 million, if the panel decides that Tarek Skubal is worth more than that, he will get what he asked for, which is $32 million. If they decide it is less than the $25.5, he will get what the Tigers filed at $19 million. The audacity of asking for $32 million is, on one hand, like, hell yeah, dude, you're Tarek Skubal, you're the best pitcher in the world. On the other hand, because of the precedent, is pretty ludicrous. With all that said, Jack Harris, I cede it to you. You don't have to make the final ruling, but let's talk it out here. Is this a win, a draw, or a loss in the attempt? We will grade it again if this does go to a hearing. Obviously, if they lose a hearing, there's no secret what grade that's going to be. But the filing for $32 million, what do you think?
I put it as a tentative win. Okay. This is, first off, just like the most Scott Boras thing, right? Like he could is take his pitcher and say, we want... Wait, what was MLB Trade Rumors' ARB projection on him? Like 17 million or something?
Yeah. 17 or 18.
Forget that. Forget the $19.75 million David Price got a decade ago. We want the highest ARB number ever, which, you know, this is the point. Like, I think that the important thing to remember with the ARB system, like, this is the point of it, right? And Jeff Passan wrote a good story about this on ESPN yesterday, yes. Is, you know, the league would prefer just a computer, like, system and an analytics rating that would come up with these guys' salaries. The reason that the players like the ARP system is for situations like this, where you have a unique circumstance, a guy who could reset the arb market, not just for himself, but for everybody else who comes after him, which in this case, you know, includes Paul Skeens, is going to be coming down the pike through this system very quickly. And look, like the 25.5 million number that you got to go over under, a key part of this is because, as Jeff Passan wrote, because Scooble has more than 5 years of service time, like he can compare himself to anybody in baseball, not just arb eligible guys. So I looked at pitchers that made between $23 and $27 million last year. It's like Aaron Nola. It's Nola, Flaherty, Gray, Ray, Gossman, Snell, Luis Castillo. That whole group combined for an 11.9 BWAR and had an average ERA of 4. Tarik Skubal alone had a 6.5 BWAR with a 2.21 ERA, which both led the AL en route to winning another Cy Young Award. So if there was ever a time that you're going to be aggressive and say this ARB system that a lot of people on the player side thinks kind of, you know, suppresses salaries. Remember, MLB had a toy wrestling belt they would give to the team that kept salaries the lowest 5 or 6 years ago. This is the time to try to use this system to change things. And because the Tigers went so low, like that's the other part. Had the Tigers like countered at 20 or 22 million and moved that midpoint just a little bit higher, it becomes exponentially harder to prove to an arbitrator that, hey, this guy is worth this much money compared. But like the Tigers didn't even offer. And that's like the other, like, talk about audacity. For Scott Harris to not even, knowing who you're dealing with and who his agent is, to not even offer the biggest ARB salary for a pitcher.
Right.
Like, what are we doing?
Just go and 20 million. Just at least indulge them with 20 million. Like, and yet the teams look at this from such. Now, all that said, there is going to be a human component to this. Because if this goes to a hearing, I saw people wanting
it, like saying to MLB, like sell pay-per-view for this, like put it in the MLB.tv.
That's the obvious. But like, even, yes, I mean, that's the obvious joke, which I stand by. That said, just think about the assignment of the Tigers front office employee. Hey, can you go make the case for why Tarik Skubal's not that good? And do it maybe in front of Tarik Skubal? Like, have fun with that. So anyway,
he didn't pitch deeper into game 5 of the ALDS.
I just show that, you know, right. He was gassed. I mean, look what happened,
our
man.
Our hands were tied.
Lane Thomas, just show that Lane Thomas grand slam over and over and over. That's probably your best case against Tarik Skubal. So we'll see how this puts out. I agree, though. This is a win. I also love that Scott Boras has a ton of other players near the top of the arbitration projections. None of those guys are going to a hearing. From what I can tell of the 18 players that are scheduled to go to hearings, I think Skubal's the only Boras guy, which is awesome because they are going to be gearing up for that just to bring in. I hope Scott does it. You know, normally it's not the agent that goes in and does it. You know, they got a lot of people that work in these agencies that work in these cases, but I hope Boras shows up and I hope they do sell it on pay-per-view. I'll do that. I'll stream that for sure. So we'll see. All right, we'll give him a win
in the art process.
We'll give him
a
win
in this offseason.
Scott Boras moves to 13-4-10 on the winter. All right, Jack, it is time for our favorite Friday segment, the good, the bad, the ugly. Something good, something bad, something damn ugly. What does that mean? We're still trying to figure it out. I'm going to begin with something good. It's very simple. It is Julio Rodriguez renovating a ball field in his hometown of Loma de Cabrera in the Dominican Republic. And not just, you know, investing, I think, like $500,000 of his own money to turn what was essentially a patch of dirt into like a legitimate state-of-the-art facility, but to have like the entire Dominican WBC team show up to celebrate this, or at least a lot of the biggest players in his native country show up to celebrate, including, of course, a former player in Nelson Cruz, who's a very important figure in Dominican baseball, but also Vlad Jr., also Fernando Tatis Jr., also Juan Soto, also his current teammate Victor Robles and Luis Castillo and former teammate Noel V. Marte. I just love when all these guys get together and get to give back. It is just one of the easiest, coolest thing ever. And to mint this opening of the ballpark with this, you know, little get together softball game with four of the best players in the league is worth $2 billion. Like, is this an amazing reminder of what these guys have been able to accomplish to be able to give back? So it's a layup, but it brought me a lot of joy, and Julio's the coolest. So this was obviously very good.
It's got me in on Team DR too, head of the WBC. Oh, it's the kind of, yeah, you know, team it's unity. Little,
oh my God, like, for sure. It's, and the DR team, we're going to talk plenty about them leading up to the WBC. What's good for you?
I'm going to throw you can throw a little Eddie Alvarez at you. Eddie Alvarez, a temporary Dodger back in 2022, but a guy who was also an Olympic medalist in speed skating. He was one of like the first guys I covered on the Dodgers, which are like unique stories. Anyway, the Winter Classic for the NHL was at Lone Depot Park in Miami last week. Eddie Alvarez made his MLB debut in Miami as a Miami native playing for the Marlins. And so the NHL, I think, like, set up a cool thing for him where him and his family got to go on the ice, the Winter Classic ice sheet at Lone Depot Park. He's out there in his speed skates, which are also just a great visual to see, especially compared when everyone's got hockey skates on. And yeah, got to have these two very different careers in professional sports overlap in a moment that was very cool. So yeah, shout out Eddie Alvarez.
The Eddie Alvarez story is unbelievable. What if I told you this man played 51 games in AAA last year?
He's still
playing baseball. He was within AAA he played in the big leagues briefly with the Mets in 24. But was also mostly with the Red Sox. And then, yeah, 51 games with Atlanta. Did not go super great. Hit 176, but was still playing baseball in 2025. I don't know if that means he's going to be playing baseball in 2026, but I love the Eddie Alvarez story. So that is absolutely good. Let's go to bad, where we return to the Dominican Republic, where the Dominican Winter League playoffs are in progress. An 18-game round robin where the four teams that qualify play each other six times. Unfortunately for Gigantes del Cibao, they have essentially already been eliminated from championship series contention, having begun their 18-game slate 0-9, a quick little L9 to start the round robin. They finally got a win last night, which makes this a little bit less bad, but that it can't happen. Can't be going into the postseason and going 0-9. That's, I'm going to say, that qualifies as bad. They really weren't very good in the regular season either, but it all resets once you get to the round robin, and they did not take advantage of that. They fired their manager after three games, Jose Lejer, who's now on the White Sox coaching staff, but clearly Lejer was not the problem, as they then lost six more games after that, and in all likelihood will not be advancing to the championship series. So, 0-9 in any sort of postseason format is going to be a bad for me.
I do appreciate the postseason format, though, giving it, like, awesome, providing the opportunity for this to happen, where you're firing your coach in the middle of it, trying to, like, hey, there's still time to turn it around.
Guess they haven't technically been eliminated yet, so we will see if they could turn around. I'm not counting on it. All right, what's bad for you?
All right, my bad is everybody's favorite homeless MLB franchise, the formerly Oakland, don't call them Sacramento, and not yet Las Vegas Athletics, applied for a trademark for the second time. Apparently, I missed this the first time, but were denied a trademark for the Las Vegas Athletics and Vegas Athletics by the patent office last week, which led to a lot of great jokes, but also brought me to Front Office Sports wrote about this. This is unbelievable. When you go through this story, they quote a trademark attorney named Josh Gerben, who says, because the options here for the A's are, you can just keep refiling patents, or you can try to take this to court to appeal it. He goes, they could appeal this all the way to the Supreme Court. Please give me the A's having to explain their move and why they deserve the trademark for Las Vegas Athletics in front of the Supreme Court. Also, I did look up if there is another, like, Las Vegas Athletic, you know, something. Mm-hmm. Shout out to the Las Vegas Athletic Clubs, just a series of gyms around Las Vegas.
Of course. This is the problem for those trying to understand why it would get rejected. It's essentially too generic. And I think also problematic is that they're not there yet. And so I think that the fact that they haven't actually gotten there, they're like, why would we give you this, like, legal authority over this word in a place you aren't even operating yet? and it's hilarious. So yeah, I hope this goes on forever. I hope that they, like, I guess, yeah, end up changing the name. I know there are people in Oakland that like are like, yeah, don't take our, that's our team. You know, you find some other team name, you know, and figure it out. I still think that's unlikely, but it would be fun to see.
Yes. And unfortunately, it seems like once they move there, they will be able to get the trademark approved. But yeah. In the meantime,
a real shame.
Yeah, just a real shame. Another pinata moment for them.
So, YOLO County, baby. We'll stick with the YOLO A's. We'll keep calling them that. All right. My ugly this week is Kazuma Okamoto's introductory press conference in Toronto. He spoke about, Blue Jays, they're so great. They had a great postseason. They have a great team. All the reasons you would want to sign with the Blue Jays. They gave me the most money. Awesome. Love that. He didn't say that, but obviously that was part of it. However, he also gives us this detail. This is courtesy of the interpreter who is up there. Gino Gordon, I believe is his name. I'm not sure if he's going to be permanent there, but essentially, you know, he's asked, hey, why'd you pick the Blue Jays? He said, quote, via the interpreter, I put all 30 logos in front of my daughter and said, which one do you like the most? She pointed at the Blue Jays. I've seen some other translations from some Japanese media suggesting that she also or separately said it was the cutest logo, which is interesting. I don't know how old Okamoto's daughter is. Whatever. Me bringing this up as an ugla is not necessarily meant to interrogate the truth of this story. However, it is objectively very funny. Like, I'm not, like, it's, I'm just imagining this scenario, and it's like, you know, okay, here, pick one. And she points at the Royals, and he's like, oh, not that one. Try again. Like, how many, like, because if not, like, this really, if this is exactly what happened, I mean, wow. And what logo was it? You know, the Blue Jays have some alts, you know, was she pointing at, mm-hmm. at, like, the old school bird? Was she pointing at just the Canadian, you know, logo motif? I don't know. Like, I would love some more details here. It's not that I'm skeptical that this happened, but I just, the premise, of course, is plastered everywhere. It's a headline everywhere. It is cute. I'm not taking away from how adorable this is in theory, but there's just parts about it that make me laugh, as from a practical standpoint.
I do like the visual of, like, just the hats are in a circle, and, like, she starts in a circle,
right? Exactly.
One, yeah,
it's a lot of hats.
She starts going towards, like, you know, the A's maybe, and he's like, no, right. we're gonna move this one. Sorry, I gotta move you this way.
Right. Because all 30, yeah. This isn't like a signing day where it's like, okay, I gotta pick it between three schools. It's like all 30, man. Like, if she really picked that, like, that's pretty awesome. So, anyway. I just think there's just a tinge of ugliness, so I wanted to include it.
I like that. all right. My ugla.
Finish your ugla.
Speaking of trademarking things, Tommy Pham has an idea that Will Salmon and Eno Saris wrote about in The Athletic this week for an idea called Pham Graphs. I actually really love this idea. It is a sort of undefined analytic that Tommy Pham wants to come up with that accounts for currently unaccounted for factors such as, hey, if you play on a bad team, like maybe the Pittsburgh Pirates, you face a lot of really good relief pitchers because you're always losing at the end of games and they have a chance to finish those games off. If you are, you know, batting at the bottom of the lineup and you have a good at-bat, that should be rewarded. If you're one of the few good hitters in a lineup and a pitcher, you know, can focus on you more, that should be accounted for, which actually is a theory I do like because it does hit on a dynamic that, you know, I think you experience a lot when you talk to players about, like, actual analytics, which is the critique is always that there are circumstantial factors, right, that are very important to players on a daily basis, like who they get to face coming out of the bullpen, what the guy does in front of them in an at bat, stressing a pitcher, like all these things really matter to these guys in a way that does not get captured in things like OPS plus or WRC plus or whatever else. So I appreciated just the fact that, like, he came up with this and was willing to put it out. The ugla of this, though, is that this whole story took me to Tommy Pham's Twitter account, which is a great place to visit. Now, he was responding. He was making a lot of very good, genuine responses to people who had actual questions about, like, how would this work, whatever. And then there was a tweet from somebody called @AngrySchneider at TFAMLV. He should also add a stat category of how many fights he's tried to start for stupid reasons. His trophy case would be so large he'd have to buy another house. Of course, Tommy Pham replies to this, I don't start blank. I finish it. But what's wild to me is guys that actually have fought on teams that you never talk about that you think is a great guy teammate. I won't say names, but it's funny to me. The only thing that made this better is that I scroll down and the very next tweet I see is Tommy Pham tweeting about how he won his fantasy football leagues this year, which ties directly back into the, you know, the fights he may or may not have started during his career.
Infamous slap. Yeah.
Yeah, but just the Tommy Pham experience. And I think it's a great encapsulation of this guy who, like, if you talk to people in baseball, like, Tommy Pham's a pretty well-liked, well-respected guy because on the one hand, he can think very deeply about the game in a way most guys don't. And on the other hand, he can come back to a fan talking smack about how he starts fights and shuts them down right there. So Tommy Pham, that's my Uglow this week.
He is just perpetual. He's going to be providing Uglows as long as he wants. Dude still gets on base. So there's a lot with the Pham graphs. There's already been a lot written about some of the legitimate points of quote unquote Pham graphs and also the parts that like doesn't make any sense.
Some of the outfield defense stuff.
It's windy. Why don't you account for that? Well, so sometimes they do whatever. There's also like a tiny part. Well, I'm not going to say that. Never mind. Okay. All that said, a wonderful edition of Good, Bad, and Ugly. Thank you so much, Jack Harris, for joining me on this journey, your Barbacast debut. Hopefully you had a decent time.
I had a great time. Scouting out the Good, Bad, and Ugly stuff like is a very enjoyable like way to spend a couple hours during the week.
Thank
you for that.
Thank you for indulging. Thank you to Lance Brozdowski for joining, talking Edward Cabrera, Owen Casey, and more. Thank you to Ingrid Rosas and Andrew Hartz for producing, as always. Jake Mintz will finally return next week, for better or for worse. I'm certainly looking forward to it, and maybe we will have some actual big-time signings to talk about. But until then, everyone have a good weekend.